Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I'm very honored to have as my guest Edward P. Jones. His new book is his first novel, The Known World. He's written a book of short stories called Lost in the City. And I have to tell you that when I read The Known World, I knew I was holding in my hands a book of great beauty, but more than that, importance, a book that people are going to be reading for years. It seemed to me that I was present at the publication of something like The Invisible Man, that we would be encountering and exploring for a very long time. It seems to me to be an incontestably great book. Now, this is your first novel, and it seems to me to be nearly astonishing to have heard that, by and large, you had written it in your head first. What does that mean?
Well, I had about 40 or so books on slavery that I had accumulated by 1992 when the first book came out. And my thought was that what I would do is read all of those books and prepare myself for writing about this world, antebellum Virginia. Well, starting in 92, what would happen is that I would read a chapter or so of one book, one I tried to get through. And a number of things would happen here and there, distractions. But I think by and large, I just simply wasn't moved to do all of that research and read all of those books. By the time I sat down to do the writing of the novel in 2001, I had, of all those 40 or so books, I think I may have read 150 pages. And I had some notes that I had taken in the reading of those pages. While I was not reading and researching, I was still working this novel out in my head. You know, I just kept saying, okay, you can't do the physical work, you know, sitting at the computer. But I allowed myself to start creating the world, you know. And by the time 2001 rolled around, when I sat down, I had about 18 pages, about 12 pages, six of the first chapter and six of the final chapter. And I think what happened then is that I said to myself, well, you haven't done the research, but you're really jazzed up about this. So give yourself a few pages to work on it, you know. And so I did those pages. But those 12 pages, that was all I had. Everything else was in my head because I was still waiting for the day when I would get up and start reading all those books.
I'm talking to Edward P. Jones, the author of The Known World. It's his first novel. Now, as I read about Elias and as you go on in this book, time becomes fluid. Mm-hmm. It's central event, the stout stick, I think, that Sally Gordon once told Flannery O'Connor you needed to start a novel, you needed to plant a stout stick somewhere, is the death of the master, Henry Townsend. And we learn within a couple of paragraphs that Henry Townsend was a black man, that he owned 33 slaves, that he was 31 years old. And from that point on, in a sense, we leave the known world.
Yeah.
In other words, whatever we know about slavery and its justifications are going to be stood on their head.
Yes. Yeah.
And we're going to have to rethink this entirely as something. Here we have a town, it is fictional, but based in history, Manchester, where there are, of the 35 black families who have managed to purchase their freedom, eight of them own slaves. Mm-hmm. Am I getting that kind
if
of
right? I remember
right?
The numbers, yes.
Yeah.
It was a minority of the ones, free ones, yes.
Now,
yes.
I would imagine that as soon as you are given that as something of a fact that the levels of confusion, indignation, compassion, outrage would mobilize enough for any novel to reach points of emotion and intensity that are uncharacteristic. When had you first learned that there were slave-owning black families?
In sometime in college. And I don't remember if a professor mentioned it in passing or if it was some footnote. I just remember coming upon that and being rather quite surprised, of course, because up until then slavery had always been black and white. You know, and here you come across this thing where black people participated in a system that was oppressing everyone else. At that time, when I learned about it, I had no intention of becoming a writer, so I just sort of filed it away in my head, along with a lot of other things you learn when you're in college, you know. And sometime, I think, maybe around the time when I was writing Lost in the City, the idea sort of came back to me, and it was already beginning to take a certain form and shape even before I finished Lost in the City. And then once Lost in the City was out, then I began thinking about how I was going to shape this novel.
One of the most unusual things, bordering on astonishing, there's very little judgment in the book. We're not making our way through these pages by and large saying, how could they, white or black, they are living in a world that seems to have generated the idea of slavery before they've come into it.
Yes.
And the black families say, well, you know, there are slaves in the Bible.
Yeah.
God accepts it.
Yep.
You know, there's, yeah. I was a slave.
Yes.
Part of rising in the world is to own other people.
Yeah.
This is a mark of how far I've come.
Exactly, yeah.
And very few of the people, except for people like Henry's father, Augustus, he's bought his own freedom, but he's shocked that his son would become a slave owner.
Right, right. And I think for Henry and for the other black slave owners, like Fern Elson, the teacher, it is, first and foremost, that's what Fern tells a Canadian pamphleteer. It's in the Bible. And the law says we can own people, therefore we will do it. For Henry, I think the thing is that first Augustus's father bought his own freedom, and then he bought his wife's freedom. And then there were all these years when Henry didn't have a father. He didn't have someone he could look up to and guide him. But there was William Robbins, the white master, who owned Henry up until his father bought his freedom. And that's the guy. That's the person he follows. And, of course, William Robbins believes profoundly in slavery and what it's all about. You know, he has a number of contradictions, but he believes in slavery. And I think that's sort of because he and Henry spent a lot of time together. And I think he absorbed all of that.
Now, the book has as its crisis point, in a sense, a question of identity. Moses, who has always been a slave, owned by two white men and then by a black man, has built the mansion at the center of this plantation with Henry. He's watched Henry marry his wife, Caldonia, to the point that he can tell her stories after she dies, stories he mostly makes up about the heroism of her husband before she met him. He even seems to be about to take Henry's place in Caldonia's bed. And there's a kind of very complex, almost nonverbal choice that he makes about whether to take the reins and make this place the plantation Henry kept, but more so, or to let it go and let it slide. And he lets people escape with all sorts of complicated motive.
Yeah, yeah.
And it seems as if, for him, the moments of his decision have to do with moments of enormous privacy. He would go to the woods in the early morning and lie naked and masturbate in the grass.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And his terror of having been seen by a woman thought to be crazy, a woman named Alice, seems to precipitate some sense that in those moments when you are no one, when you reach for yourself and yourself is your body, that this is the time whatever is inchoate in you comes forth. Is this?
Yeah, you're saying this, and I think maybe that was a part of it in my brain when I was doing it, because I knew that I wanted to open a book with him there and alone in the woods and everything. I didn't always know why, you know. I think there were two or three things going on when I said, well, this is where I'm going to start. One of them, I think, is that, and this I realized after my editor sent it back to me last fall, and she just wanted me to make minor, she suggested minor changes. For example, Moses, his name was originally Adolphus, and she said, well, she didn't want two major characters with beginning names A and ending with U.S., so I changed it to Moses. Actually, that was a nice thing down the line. Because she asked for so little, I went over the entire manuscript again, and I began to ask myself, what was it that allowed some people to survive slavery? And I looked at Celeste, the crippled woman, and her husband Elias, and I said, well, possibly it's family. They had each other. They had their children. And something else happened with the character Stanford down the line, and maybe I'll get to that later. But I told myself that family was one of the things that allowed people to survive. And the tragedy of Moses is that he throws his family away.
You're listening to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and my guest is Edward P. Jones. We're talking about his magnificent novel, The Known World, published by Amistad. In the last story of your first collection, Lost in the City, a woman, a 91-year-old woman named Marie, does some oral history with a young man who has to knock at her door for quite a while before she'll open it. She knows what the door is likely to open to. And it seemed to me, since I had read that your mother did not read or write, that the oral traditions are very much a part of what you're bringing to this book. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. When I was growing up, my mother, she was most comfortable around women who were far older than she was, because she wasn't a party person. She wasn't a drinker. Her whole life was her children. And we would, on Sundays particularly, would go to friends of hers, older women, and in between my reading my funny books, or call them comic books, I would listen to what they were talking about. And this sense of words and how they come across, and you create pictures in your mind with what people are saying, I think that sort of started there. For me, it's all about creating pictures.
Well, it seems to me also that for you, storytelling sort of depends upon eventually finding a new order for things. That Lost in the City begins with a story of a young girl.
Yeah.
But by the time we get to the end, you have to be a little bit blind not to notice that the characters in the stories are getting older and older, and the last story is about a 91-year-old woman.
Hey, you don't think you may be the first person to realize that there was a reason to my madness. It begins with an infant and ends with the oldest person. Yes,
that's right.
Yes.
And it seemed to me that in the known world, I don't know how you did this, and I couldn't make it specific, and maybe you'll help me. I began to notice that all the chapters, each chapter, has three sections. The sections, as you move along, seem to reflect one another. I don't know how to put this, but there are things going on about people's relationships to a horse versus a mule. Things that kind of evolve sneakily through the book that seem to have to do, while these characters are failing to evolve a complex ethic. Mm-hmm. They know simple things about the differences between horses and mules, almost as if the book is telling us, this is what you can know in the known world, and then there's that other world in which no one knows the right behavior, so no one behaves very well. They're all trying, but they're all, in a sense, doomed to experiences of greater and greater chaos.
I think is I wanted to show how just topsy-turvy this whole place was, you know, starting, of course, with that sort of 300, 400-year-old map that the sheriff has on the jail cell in the jail. And it's a weird look. If the description I have of it is that, you know, it's if you looked at it, I suppose you would have thought that a child had made that. Because Florida's missing. North America is not called North America. It doesn't have a name. South America is called South America. But I wanted to show in that thing how really strange this world was. Moses, the overseer, the black overseer, mentions, you know, it was already a strange world when he was owned by white people. And now it's really, really strange now that he's owned by a black person. And he asks, you know, is God even up there anymore attending to business? And that's what it's what that all of them can ask that, you know, because everything is just so thrown up into the air there. I mean, a free man who's been free for a long time can, you know, in seconds, all of a sudden, be a slave again. You know?
Well, Elias has the advantage over others. It's said that he doesn't have any belief in a sane God.
Yeah.
He believes in God, but not a sane one.
Yeah, yeah.
and it seems to be, in turn, some of the job of this book to locate not whether God exists, but what would be his nature if he did, given that this world is the reflection of his majesty. But what do you make of the book's religious sense, or what did you put in it and hope to find there?
I had a sense that, as Moses says, you know, as he wonders whether God is even up there tending business, and that was my sense, that God is up there. My strange thing is that, so I'm not a religious person, but whenever I think about God and the fact that, you know, when the world goes, does something really strange out here, because like September 11th or something, my image of God becomes this, you know, in the movies you see these Romans and everything, the rich Romans, and they're lounging around and people are peeling grapes for them, and they get up and they go into the vomitorium and everything. Well, that's my image of God. You know, he's having a party all the time. And he's not really attending to business, you know, because so many horrible things are happening to people. So how can there be a God? He can't be attending to business. And that's the image that I had. The thing, though, is that because I'm not religious, I'm also doomed to write about people who are. And so I never try to step on their beliefs. John Skiffington believes passionately in God and in the Bible, and I never try to make fun of him. And that's also the case with everybody else. I have my own beliefs, but I never want to put them in the novel. And I think that sort of goes over to even when I was to writing about all the characters, is that I wanted to make them as full as I possibly could, especially with the people who were pretty bad. Harvey Travis, you know, he does his thing to Augustus. It just really is one of the worst things in a book. But I remember when I got to that point, when this thing happens, and it would have been so easy to follow the wagon that takes Augustus away, you know, to follow it out there into the night. Instead, I made the decision to stay with Harvey and sort of give the reader some idea. You can't explain away what he did, but my hope is that by the end of that chapter, you have a fuller sense of who he is.
We're getting an aerial view as well of a time where we still don't understand our own morality.
Yeah.
We're being asked to look at the past, 1855, from above. But none of the questions that are involved in issues of slavery have been solved. No. Slavery has been abolished.
Yeah, and they went on with their lives. No one sat around and said, let's discuss this. How do we get into this? And where do we go from here?
And what does it mean? And who are we that we would do such a
thing? Exactly, yeah, yeah.
And that seems to be what the book is on the verge of.
Yeah, yeah. I think it has a lot to do with the way the country is. America doesn't like to ask a lot of hard questions. You know, it has a certain myth about itself, and it puts that out there for the world to see. One interesting thing, a few months ago I saw on PBS a documentary about Benjamin Franklin. And, you know, you go to school, and what you learn is America got its freedom through fighting. Well, this documentary showed that there was an awful lot of work done by Franklin in France and in England that had a lot to do with how this country got to be free. But the people, the powers that be at that time, wanted the world to believe that the freedom was attained through fighting. And so Franklin's role as a diplomat has been reduced. You know, you have to really search and search and find, you know, what it is he did. And that extends from 1776 all the way through to 1860. I mean, slavery ended with the Civil War. Went on with their lives. No one ever sat around and said, you know, let's discuss this. Let's talk about this for ourselves and for the future of this country. And, of course, because I was in 2001, I could still see the result of this inability to talk and discuss. Maybe it was impossible for that to happen because the South certainly wouldn't have wanted that. You know, they live on bitterness, you know. So maybe any sort of proper dialogue could never have happened. So we're talking about something that just would have been impossible.
You know, this book has been and will continue to be nominated for any number of prizes. It would be my choice for whatever it's nominated that it be the winner, because it's the book that just rattled me around. I found myself, as I haven't in years, I can read anything. Sometimes the intensities of the injustice in the book would require that I set it down wait while I had some time to get finished rambling.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier, I think before we started recording, about the thing that happened with Augustus. And I had a feeling, you know, how hard that – I didn't know that their readers would take it that way, to heart what happened to him. And I think one of the reasons why I sort of threw in some humor with that, with these two people who take him, is because it's such a horrible thing that happens to him. The whole tone of it, I wanted to just – to write the novel without shouting – without raising my voice, because I felt that the people, every single person in there, the life was compelling enough that I didn't need to use what I've begun to call neon language, you know. It's gratifying to hear people say that they have been moved, that they have been touched, because I wanted that to happen, but I didn't want to shout about it.
Well, there's one section in which we hear a shout taking place at the level of a whisper. And I wonder if you'll read it for us, because it's one of these places where you can't help but be aware of what the novelist is feeling, because you're feeling it as a reader, too. Caldonia, who's having trouble maintaining her plantation and her slaves the way her husband maintained them, is speaking with a life insurance salesman who's offering masters life insurance for the slaves. This is the insurance salesman's visit to Caldonia after the death of her husband, Henry Townsend.
That Friday, Ray Topps, the man from Atlas Life Casualty and Insurance Company, returned and had no trouble getting in to see Caldonia. He came with Maud, a widower with 9 children, including 3 unable to walk and 1 unable to see or hear. A man who had failed at his patent medicine business, Topps had many papers, which he was eager to show Caldonia. All the papers had the name of the company spelled AETLAS. Unfortunately, he explained, sitting next to her on the settee, there seems to have been an abundance of ease at this particular printer's. But I assure you, we have always been known as Atlas, and we always will be. Your children will know us as that, and so will your grandchildren. Their children will know the same. For the moment, with all the talk of children, he forgot he was talking to a childless widow. You get the meaning I'm trying to convey to you, Mrs. Tarleton, he said, seeing his mistake, and Cardona said that she did. Tops told her that for 15 cents a head every 2 months, her property, each working slave over 5 years old, would be protected from just about everything God could think of. Getting kicked in the head by a mule while working a field, dying from tainted food, as long as the doctor could certify the food was not simply rancid and that any normal person could have eaten it and not had the same death visited upon him. Breaking a neck in a well after falling down in it while cleaning it out. Getting bit by a snake of 1 foot or longer while working in the fields of the barn or the smokehouse or the tobacco barn or the corn crib. Said snake, alive or dead, would soon be missing fang or fangs, would have to be produced to collect on the policy. Slave death by mad dogs in fall, winter, or spring was compensable. Canine madness in the summer was an ordinary act of God to be expected, so the policy was mute about that season. Nothing came from the loss of an arm or of one or both eyes, because such losses were not the best indicia of how much work a slave could still perform. Being hurt in any fashion by duly authorized slave catchers was compensable. Plain citizens, opportunistic slave catchers just out to make a dollar, hurting a runaway, would make that provision in the policy null and void. Being killed or injured by a neighbor while walking across a neighbor's property while on an errand of consequence for the master or the mistress or their issue. No money for a slave hurt or killed by someone while said slave was visiting his family on another plantation. Being accidentally shot while assisting the master, mistress, their issue, while hunting or while traveling, with said people, as long as travel was of 3 days' duration or longer. Being struck by lightning while working in the field, as long as recuperation was less than 3 days, and as long as the slave had not been given sufficient warning that lightning was about to strike. Death by lightning was not compensable. Such deaths were simply another ordinary act of God that the company, in its wisdom, could not reward.
I've been speaking to Edward P. Jones, author most recently of The Known World. Thank you, Edward, for joining me.
Thank you for inviting me.
You can read the first chapter of The Known World on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Ray Guarna. Special production assistance from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword Bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Everything, they're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.